Today, welcome to the Twilight Zone. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post, covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today we're going to update the markets, but also do a deep dive on what's going on in the Australian economy, because there are some very significant questions we need to ask. But first, the S&P 500 ended the week in the red on Friday, despite a rebound in tech and a rally in economically sensitive value stocks, amid optimism the consumer remains in good shape to support the recovery. At the close in New York, the Dow Jones Industrial gained 1.06%, while the S&P 500 climbed 1.49%, and the Nasdaq gained 2.32%, but they're still down over the week. The best performers on the Dow were Goldman Sachs, up 2.77% to 368.75, and the weekly loss for the broader market followed a wobble earlier this week when fears of runaway inflation prompted investors to hit pause on the stocks. Retail sales, which were reported on Friday, were flat in April after an upwardly revised 10.7% jump in the prior month as spending fueled by stimulus checks dried up. But with consumers hoarding record amounts of cash for the progress on the reopening of the economy, we'll see spending return in the spring and the summer, they said. Stimulus checks were mostly used up in March spending, but households now hold larger savings than they did pre-pandemic. Grant Thornton said in a note, new CDC guidance saying that vaccinated people no longer need to wear masks, added to more states reopening in May, will lead to more consumer activity during the spring and summer months. Consumer spending, which makes up two-thirds of the economy, has been earmarked by some as the key to sustaining the broader market rally, particularly in the cyclicals corner of the market, as the support from monetary and fiscal stimulus will eventually be reined in. Going forward, as federal stimulus runs dry, consumer spending will be reliant on more organic means, such as job and income growth, hence the Twilight Zone. Cyclicals, including financials, consumer discretionary, energy, were in the green, with energy leading the pack up more than 3% amid rising oil prices. Crude oil for delivery in June rose 2.48% to hit $65.40 a barrel. And the reopening trade was also in vogue, supported by airlines and cruise lines, both up strongly. Tech stocks, meanwhile, continued to make gains as their recent rout appears to have made their valuations, which are sensitive to a faster pace of inflation, more palatable. Facebook was up 3%. Google's parent Alphabet, Microsoft, and Amazon gained more than 2%, and Apple also ended up about 2% higher. And Tesla, the sixth biggest weighting on the S&P 500, was up 3%. On the earnings front, meanwhile, high-flying tech names including Airbnb and DoorDash that had been battered recently returned to investors' shopping lists. DoorDash raises outlook on order value for the rest of the year after reporting earnings that missed, but revenue that topped analyst estimates. Its share price rose more than 22%, and Airbnb reported better than expected quarterly revenue and said bookings were gaining momentum as the global travel restrictions eased, sending its shares 4% higher. The volatility index was down 18.68% to 1881, reversing earlier rises in the week, and gold futures for June delivery were 1.04% higher to 1,842. The euro-US dollar was up 0.53% to 1.2143, while the dollar index futures was down 0.46% to 90.31. Now, the New York Federal Reserve announced that the issuance patterns of Treasury securities have changed over the past year, resulting in modest shifts in the distribution of Treasury securities outstanding. As a result, the desk will segment its purchase sectors for longer-dated securities into additional maturity ranges to reflect last year's introduction of new benchmark securities. This adds more weight, in fact, to the longer-term section of the yield curve, which they, of course, are wanting to control. The 30-year long bond was down 0.36% to 2.347. The benchmark 10-year was up slightly to 1.635. And the 3-year was down very slightly to 0.329, so really not much to see there. The cryptocurrency market is in a recovery phase following a massive dump initiated on May the 13th after Tesla's CEO Elon Musk announced that the electric car company would suspend its acceptance of Bitcoin as a form of payment while citing concerns relating to the energy required to mine cryptocurrencies. Following the recovery, Bitcoin and the majority of altcoins were seen trading in the green. Dogecoin, or Dogecoin, depending on how you want to call it, rallied when Elon Musk hinted at improving the network's transaction efficiency, stating that Tesla and its CEO were working with Doge developers. Coinbase also announced it would be listing Doge in 6 to 8 weeks, and dog-themed token Dogalon Mars rallied 36.22% in the last 24 hours and 192.57% weekly. Well, speculation is still, of course, rife. Ethereum regained the 4,000 level while Bitcoin returned to trade above 50,000 at the time of writing. Now, back in Australia, columnist Laura Tingle wrote that Australians are stuck in a gilded cage until the election. The budget represented one of the most spectacular and opportunistic vault farces in political ideology in the last 30 years. Jos Frydenberg's third budget speech had barely been delivered in the House of Representatives on Tuesday night when the focus of the budget coverage seemed to become overwhelmed by the COVID-19 vaccine rollout and what it meant for when borders would open and for the economic outlook. Given that the budget represented one of the most spectacular and opportunistic vault farces in political ideology in the past 30 years, the government may have been quietly grateful for this. Maybe the government wants people to feel safe in the gilded cage until after the next election. The debt and deficit parsimony that has driven the coalition's often ideological cuts to government spending and which drove the coalition's relentless political attack on Labour has been put into the cupboard, at least for now. It has been stashed away in deference to a newfound homage to, dare one say, jobs and growth, even as the spending still flowing through the economy from last year's emergency measures is set to deliver a better jobs outcome than existed in the pre-pandemic and debt and deficit era. Understand, it's not a new ideology, mind. The Treasurer and Prime Minister repeatedly reminded us this week that they had got the tick off on the change in the approach from the High Priest of Debt and Deficits, John Winston Howard himself. Turns out that they had both had the very same conversation last year with a former Prime Minister who had assured them that in times of crisis there is no ideological constraints. Aged care package aside, the third Frydenberg budget was a studied exercise in throwing money unimaginatively at every political problem thrown up by focus groups for which the government needs an alibi and at setting up the spending it will need in the election campaign, more money into community grant programs of the sort that became so notorious last time around, and stashing some $12 billion of revenue and spending decisions in the back pocket as decisions taken but not yet announced. So we wonder what those might be. We can probably guess, actually. This will all be financed by a remarkable snapback in the economy powered by huge amounts of government spending and debt, which has kept the economy afloat and now powers households to keep things moving along 2021 and into early 2022. But as AIG's Innes Willicks said this week, it is a budget that describes an economic gilded cage that cannot last. we are enjoying the confidence effects of a country cut off from the world and feeling safe from the pandemic that rages pretty much everywhere else. But we are an economy built on open borders, particularly for people, given the huge service exports, international students, tourists, migrants, and we've cultivated this in the last 40 years. So there will be an inevitable reckoning. We either completely change the nature of our economy or find a way back to the sort of trade we saw in the past. Closed borders have been a positive that's allowed us a competitive advantage in the short term. The deeply disturbing part of the budget's economics and politics is that it has not told us how we can get back to where we came from, nor how we can retain the competitive advantage as other countries leap ahead of our vaccination program and open for business once more. The Morrison government has seen state governments that took hard lines on borders be rewarded at the polls for their stance and has decided to do the same. But the political and economic equation for the federal government must be different from those of the states. Closed borders are a positive only while the economy that most people experience feels strong. The politics of closed borders in Queensland and Western Australia were also built on impressions of competent government. It gets more complicated if there are repeated questions about the competence of the vaccine rollout and the perceptions built that this is in fact threatening the economic outlook. If there was something lacking in the budget, it was a comprehensive roadmap of what we will need to do to get out of our gilded cage. As most things during the pandemic, the question of opening our borders is much more complicated than just the level of vaccinations in the Australian population, important although that may be. That's partly because no matter how relatively effective the various vaccines are in preventing you from getting really sick or dying, no one is really sure whether they stop the transmission of COVID-19 to other people. Also, as epidemiologist Tony Blakely points out, without children being vaccinated, which is not currently happening because the trials haven't been done yet, at least 25% of the population isn't going to be vaccinated, even if every other person in the country was. And there are decisions, protocols and systems to be put in place to determine and monitor incoming travellers' vaccination obligations and quarantine requirements. There's got to be a system of levels of risk for different countries, different risks for travellers depending on what they intend to do and when they get here, and different quarantine arrangements. Just as the government either did not feel inclined to tell us or seemed not to have worked out beforehand just what its plan would be for getting Australian citizens home safe from India, or what it would do to take advantage of the 2-week pause in flights from India, it has missed a huge opportunity to take the community into confidence about its plans for reopening the borders. There are lots of people and groups having these discussions in the community right now and with the government. Universities have been developing detailed proposals to bring in small groups of international students from low-risk countries such as Singapore, with everything from vaccination and quarantine protocols to ground transport and accommodation being thought through. Why is it that our government doesn't want to be having that conversation now? Why is it that the federal government fights so strenuously against any perception that it is responsible for the quarantine system? Most medical experts take as given that we now face an ongoing need for significantly expanded quarantine facilities, some purpose-built for high-risk groups. Yet the federal government, which has a constitutional responsibility for quarantine, even as it farms this out to the states, insist on being seen as a passive player in this crucial debate, which perhaps more than the vaccines will ultimately determine the extent to which we can open the borders. Is it because the government wants people to feel safe in the gilded cage until after the next election? If you have abandoned your ideology and are simply running on a transactional basis, that would make sense. But it would also mean sacrificing the advantage we enjoyed to date. Just as all the talk 12 months ago of how the pandemic was an opportunity to remodel the economy has vanished without a trace. and elsewhere, a leading credit rating agency has warned that Labour's plans to inject up to $45 billion into special investment funds for housing, the energy grid, and manufacturing could weigh on Australia's AAA rating. While the so-called off-budget spending has the political advantage of appearing to be fiscally responsible by not increasing the deficit, the investments would still be counted as debt by credit rating agency S&P Global Ratings. Both Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese have made off-budget spending a feature of their budget week pitches. Labour is exploring using more off-budget measures to pay for its policies, while the opposition leader Anthony Albanese also flagged policies to help people buy their own homes as he seeks to make soaring house prices a key campaign theme. The centrepiece of Albanese's budget reply speech on Thursday night was the creation of a $10 billion fund to help build 30,000 low-cost houses, including those for frontline workers locked out of inner city suburbs near to where they work, and for emergency accommodation for partners and children fleeing domestic violence. The future fund would assume responsibility for investing the $10 billion, with the dividends used to pay community housing providers a service payment, the gap between the tenant's rent and the cost of providing the housing. Labour argues that social housing funds would be an investment and would not detract from the budget bottom line. It is the third such finance vehicle the opposition had pledged to create that would be deemed off budget. Last year, Albanese pledged to create a $20 billion Rewiring the Nation corporation that would lend money or take out equity to upgrade the electricity transmission network as more renewable energy entered the grid. And at Labour's National Conference in March, Albanese announced a $15 billion loan scheme seeded with contributions from government, industry and superannuation funds to encourage local manufacturing as a recession recovery measure. But the government has also used off-budget measures for projects such as the massive Snowy Hydro 2 and the MBN. One senior Labour source said the opposition was considering further opportunities to use off-budget measures that leveraged private and public investments, but would not be drawn on what that might be. It's not the end of our possible policies of doing it off budget, using the power of the future fund to invest in assets that generate a return, the source said. Another source said the success of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation had inspired Labour to examine using off budget measures, but stressed it was conceivable the opposition would not go beyond the three announced. We've been attracted by this idea of co-investment for a long time, but we're not going to go overboard with them, the source said. Now, S&P Global analyst Anthony Walker said such funds still increase the deficit and debt because S&P looked at all transactions, including those below the line on the budget, when assessing a government's credit rating. Investments in less liquid assets by the Future Fund and other government investments such as the MBN and Snowy Hydro add to the debt in S&P's calculations. It does add up, Walker said. If governments borrow, that implies they're running deficits. So it doesn't really matter what they're quoting as the underlying cash balance for us. Commonwealth Bank of Australia analysts this week warned that Australia could lose its coveted AAA credit rating, with forecasts for persistent budget deficits over the next decade putting government debt on a trajectory inconsistent with a top-tier rating. Government net debt is forecast to increase to $617.5 billion, or 30% of GDP, this year, and peak at $980.6 billion, or 40.9% of GDP, in June 2025. The rating downgrade would come as soon as September, when S&P Global Ratings undertakes its next annual review of Australia's credit rating. Federal Housing Minister Michael Sukkar attacked the Housing Fund policy, saying Labour would need to extract 20% annual returns to make it add up. But opposition housing spokesman Jason Clare said the policy was modelled on the New South Wales Liberal government's similar scheme, which cost $1.1 billion to underpin the construction of 3,400 homes. This is a carefully developed policy, developed with the assistance of the Parliamentary Budget Office, independently modelled conservative estimates with the assistance of the people who are building these homes right now, he said. And Albanese said Labour would have more to say about helping out home buyers locked out of the property market. There are separate policies that can assist people into private home ownership, he said. Let me say this, the idea that in Australia everyone can get into private home ownership does not reflect the reality of Australia in 2021. And in an earlier interview with the ABC, Mr. Albanese would not be drawn on whether he would take to the next election a modified policy clamping down on negative gearing and capital gains tax breaks for investors. We'll announce all of our revenue and expenditure policies, and it'll all be fully costed before the next election, he said. And elsewhere, Sanjeev Gupta's $430 million rescue deal for the Whyalla Steelworks looks to have collapsed after Britain's Serious Fraud Office launched an investigation suspected fraud, fraudulent trading and money laundering at his GFG alliance. Mr. Gupta's white knight in Australia, White Oak Global Advisors, said late on Friday that the SFO's probe had pulled the plug on the rescue deal. As with any regulated financial institution, we are not in a position to continue discussions with any company that is under investigation by the Serious Fraud Office for money laundering, the San Francisco-based firm said. The Whyalla Steelworks, which employs around 1,500 people, has been under a cloud since Mr. Gupta's main financier, Greensill Capital, went bust in early March. Credit Suisse, a major creditor of Greensill and GFG, applied in early April to wind up the steelworks as it tries to recover billions of dollars for its investors. The White Oak deal would have replaced Greensill's funding for both Whyalla and GFG's Tarmor coal operation in New South Wales. As recently as Thursday, Mr. Gupta said GFG only needed to finish the paperwork with White Oak and the deal would have been wrapped up in 3 to 4 weeks. Despite all the noise and chaos which Greensill's collapse caused for GFG, it was relatively easy to get financing. We had many suitors, he told an in-house podcast. Mr. Gupta has also reportedly been negotiating with White Oak for fresh funds for his troubled British steel business. The SFO said its scrutiny of the financing and conduct of the business of companies within the Gupta Family Group Alliance, the GFG, would include financing arrangements with Greensill Capital UK Limited. The criminal investigation is just the latest in a series of crises for Mr. Gupta and his complex global network of companies, which began when Greensill Capital collapsed in early March. Mr. Gupta has been fighting winding up orders for some of his businesses in Britain, as well as in Australia from Credit Suisse, which ran four Greensill-related funds that ultimately bankrolled GFG. And he's also negotiating with Greensill Capital's administrators, Grant Thornton, over monies the group owes the failed financier. He is trying to sell assets, including his in-house Wylands Bank, and is negotiating with funders and investors to replace his extensive reliance on Greensill. A GFG spokesman said the company would cooperate fully with the investigation and the group would not comment further on the probe, but sought to offer reassurance that GFG was on top of its challenges. GFG Alliance continues to serve customers around the world and is making progress in the refinancing of its operations, which are benefiting from the operational improvements it's made and the very strong steel, aluminium and iron ore markets, the spokesman said. GFG Alliance comprises steel, aluminium, energy and property businesses concentrated mostly in Europe and Australia, where it owns the Whyalla Steelworks, the steel business Infrabuild and Tarmor Coal. The SFO specialises in complex financial crime and its remit includes both investigation and prosecution. Its critics say the agency often moves too slowly and infrequently and that it has a mixed record of success in prosecution. Its successful investigations often end in plea deals rather than criminal convictions of executives. The SFO's two-sentence statement on Friday said the agency would not offer any details about a live investigation. And the Financial Times reported in early April that it had seen customer invoices used by GFG as collateral to obtain receivables-based funding from Greensill Capital and ultimately from Credit Suisse's investment funds, where the customers denied ever doing business with GFG companies. GFG said in a statement at the time that these were not actual invoices, but prospective receivables, speculative invoices for potential transactions with potential customers. In a letter to the FT after the story appeared, Gupta said, "I'd like to make it clear that I refute any suggestion of wrongdoing. The headline has caused considerable damage at a critical time when we are seeking refinancing to safeguard the future of my 35,000 employees," he wrote. Greensill does not appear to be a target of the SFO investigation, but it will likely be asked to submit evidence. According to the FT, the conditions of GFG's account receivables facility with Greensill did not oblige the financier to confirm the veracity of invoices. And Germany's financial regulator, BaFin, has also said it has concerns about documentation relating to Bremen-based Greensill Bank's financing for GFG. During a special forensic audit, BaFin found that Greensill Bank AG was unable to provide evidence of the existence of receivables in its balance sheet that had been purchased from the GFG Alliance Group, the regulator said back in March. Greensill Capital declined to comment on the SFO investigation. During testimony to a parliamentary committee last Tuesday, founder Lex Greensill said that at no point would my firm have engaged in financing receivables that we knew to be fraudulent. A condition of our facilities is that they must do business with a customer and they must have a history and the data to support that. We take a secured interest where it involves a future receivable, where the goods have not yet been delivered, he said. At Greensill client MC Health, Mr. Greensill said, "Even though that company did allegedly commit fraud, we excluded the fraudulent transactions and our investors were paid under our insurance policies." And finally, a quick look at the local markets, which lifted higher on Friday after a wobbly week as it reacted to the budget. And also the US markets, but of course, let's face it, the latter cast the stronger shadow. So the ASX 200 was up 0.49% to 7,014. The financial services index was up 0.95% to 6,329. The real estate trusts were up 1.33% to 1,458. And the local volatility index was up 0.62% to 1,491. The ASX 200 futures was up 0.34% to 7,049. Amongst the banks, ANZ was up 0.99% to 2,742. CBA was up 0.63% to 96.58. NAB was up 1% to 26.22. And Westpac was up 0.87% to 25.41. Amongst the regionals, Bank of Queensland was up 0.68% to 8.82. Bendigo was up 0.25% to 10.21. Suncorp was down 0.1% to 10.29. And Macquarie Group was up 2.25% to 158.34. AMP was up 1.87% to 1.087. Genworth was up 1.5% to 2.71. And McGrath was down 0.78% to 63.5 cents. Elizabeth Road was up 4.55% to 9.2 cents. And AFG was up 0.38% to 2.64. Mortgage Choice ended up at 1.93. Afterpay Touch was up 2.19% to 86.35, but is still well down from its highs, as the question about the future of its business and the fintechs more generally remains in doubt, as interest rates may rise higher later. Symec was up 3.03% to 20.05. The Aussie US dollar was up 0.62% to 77.77 cents. The euro Aussie dollar was down 0.07% to 1.5611. The two-year bond ended at 0.098. The three-year bond ended at 0.093. And the 10-year bond was down 1.5% to 1.711. The gold Aussie cross was up 0.22% to 2,369. And the Bitcoin Aussie cross was down 0.38% to 64,913. So there you have it. I think we are in the twilight zone. There is some interesting positive news, but there's also quite a lot of negative news. And I think this is not going to shake out anytime soon. While some people are suggesting that the markets may have reached their peak, I still think there is potentially some upside still there. But it will be wobbly, fragile, and volatile. And I still think that September, October this year could well be a bit of a question mark ahead. So watch this space. I'll keep you updated. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.